So that was podcast number 11, Lee. And today we were interviewing Nikki Dibben, who is, well, she calls herself a 360 marketing strategy person. I'm sure I've got that title wrong and I'm sure she'll correct me. But that was pretty interesting, I think, don't you?
Really interesting. Really enjoyed it. Did you notice she never referred to notes once? She actually alluded to the fact that she didn't make notes at the start. So I was watching and she just knows her stuff, which is really enthusiastic, passionate yes. about this.
Yes.
And I love people like that. I could listen to her for a lot longer than what we recorded there.
Yeah, so a really infectious sort of optimism and solutionizing mm-hmm. sort of approach. And, you know, yeah, I mean, I think someone that knows the stuff as well as Nikki does and, you know, I suppose has that luxury of being able to come into a business and sort of apply all that knowledge, not knowing and not having all the baggage of the company. And I think that's how she talks in the podcast about, you know, getting a whiteboard in the afternoon and throwing everything up in the air and fixing as it comes down and gives them a plan for the next 6 months. It sounds fantastic.
I would imagine there's lots of marketing people agreeing very, very much so in terms of what how she described marketing, what yeah. it does. And it's not just like the analogy I used, colouring in people. It's actually a strategic view of your business and how to position it to the people you need to position it to effectively. I thought she's got the point across really well. So another great guest.
Yeah, I thought she was going to reach through the screen and slap you across the face when you said that marketeers are just the colouring in department.
But, well, I didn't say that. That wasn't me. Yeah, you're going to get me into trouble there. But I think she recognises that's a view from lots of people. Yeah. And Nikki's the type of person who would correct them in a right way and constructive way.
Yes, and probably not physically. No, you're absolutely right. Should we roll credits and crack on with the podcast?
Let's roll credits.
The Dead Tech Podcast with Peters and Lee.
No, it's not Peters and Lee, it's Peter and Lee.
I've just come back from Sunderland. I learned a new phrase, right? Here we go. Nay bosh, Mara. My definition of winging it is that you just need to be able to think quickly and know more than the next person in the room.
There's a clip right there.
Right on cue.
I feel under immense pressure now to be funny. Like funny haha, not funny peculiar, as my mother would say. I've realised since I hit 50, I get grumpy a lot more often, actually, I've realised.
The Dead Tech Podcast with Peter and Lee.
Right, hello and welcome to podcast number 11. This afternoon we're interviewing Nikki Dibben, who describes herself as a 360 marketing consultant, facilitator, mentor. Nikki, good afternoon. What do you describe yourself as?
Hi, firstly, thank you for having me. It's always lovely to get myself out there. I find it incredibly difficult to describe what I do for a couple of reasons. Really, I am, you know the old Chinese proverb, you know, the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago, you know, failing that, the second best time is today. I'm the strategic marketing person of that. So I can help. I work with tech companies mainly, and I'm all things marketing. The main problem is that most people think marketing is tactical and just comms. And I'm like, actually, no, marketing is what you need to get your product organized, to get your investment organized, to get your sales organized. So I'm kind of a CEO's right-hand person and chief marketing officer in one. So I'm kind of the answer to the question, you know, why should I have a marketer as my chief advisor? Well, because there's usually a gap for a proper senior marketing person in any tech company's senior management team. And you actually need it right from day one, if not before. So I do describe myself in a variety of ways. But yeah, right-hand person to a CEO of a tech company.
Well, that's a really interesting description. I think it makes perfect sense. I know originally our chief exec, Lou Yates, sort of engaged with you on LinkedIn. As I think, you know, you both sort of interested each other in the sort of comments and sort of posts you put up. And I think a couple of things that Lou, myself and Lee were sort of thinking about in terms of podcasts really hit a note. And I suppose I sort of like to wade in, I suppose, with my sort of first question to you, because we're a fintech, although we describe ourselves as debt tech, because we provide, or Trustfolio provides, digital solutions for enabling better debt solutions, effectively making debt solutions work better. But we're always conscious, we see lots of fintechs out there, And I, in previous occupations, have been approached by fintechs to endorse them. When I was running a trade body, we used to get asked that question quite a lot. And one of the big questions I often had was understanding what some of these fintechs really do. It seems to be a little bit hazy, a little bit sort of punting an idea out, lots of glitz. But when you actually drill down, there's not an awful lot to it. Is that the way business is being done these days?
It's not the way business should be being done. Unfortunately, where we've got to now is, you know, in ye olde days, you know, you used to have, you know, a proper technology, you had to properly build a business around. And now it's just really, really easy. You know, there's a whole world of, you know, non-tech founders can get a tech product out and all that stuff. And unfortunately, you know, there will always be bad actors. And it's not necessarily anything has changed. I think the problem is it's easier to make a big noise about something non-existent now than it would have been, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. Even simple things like building a website. You know, ages ago, we had to, you know, allow tens of thousands of pounds, allow 6 months, know that once it was up there, it was going to last for years and years and years. If we wrote a brochure, we knew we were going to have to print it. We knew we were going to have to print loads of them. And so now this whole, well, I can do anything instantly, you know, it's kind of both a blessing and a curse, because it means we can update things when they really need updating. But it also gives us opportunity to kind of go, oh, excellent, I've had an idea. So by tomorrow, it's going to be a product, you know, with a website and with everything that goes with it. And aren't I great? And so, you know, I just think the opportunity is, you know, as I said, it's a blessing and a curse, in that I think proper business people don't do business any differently, but I think there's just a lot more, you have to kind of cut through a lot more nonsense to get to the actual substance now.
I mean, I don't blame entrepreneurs for punting an idea out to see if there's interest, perhaps to get feedback, perhaps to fine tune the proposition before maybe they've even developed it. And again, you know, is that just being made easier by the medium? I mean, here we are making a podcast in my cellar, and it's going to go out, I'm going to take video clips, and goodness knows what, I'm doing the same thing. And you know, is the way the world is today, is that just making that whole process a bit easier? When does it have to stop and become something real?
I mean, one argument is that the minute money changes hands, you know, you kind of have to start making things be significantly more real. But it kind of comes down to the buyer, really, because I get there is this whole, you know, minimum viable product thing, and there's various definitions of minimum viable product. And I actually do what I call like a minimum viable customer concept, which is kind of different in that it's where your minimum viable product meets your ideal customer persona. And it's just a few people where that overlaps. So it's a few people who like what you do and will sort of invest in what you do and play with your product and give you good feedback and so on. And to me, everything is iterative. So I don't think there's a need to kind of go, we've gone from 0 to 100% of a product, you know, give us your money now. But I do think that people should be properly called out for lying, you know, because the world is iterative, it's really easy to have your grand plan. But I feel you should be really clear about what can leave the building, you know, what people can actually play with and look at and test. And then you get into the world of prototypes as well, which is very different from a minimum viable product. So your minimum viable product has to be something you can actually use, albeit with minimum functionality. Whereas a prototype can be smoke and mirrors, because it's just a representation of what the real thing will look like. Now, where I feel people go wrong is if they say, this is my minimum viable product, and it's actually merely a smoke and mirrors prototype. And that's not a good way to operate any business, I would suggest. And in the fullness of time, one would hope that, you know, these people will be, you know, figured out. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, if from the customer perspective, you know, if you give somebody money, it's kind of up to you really to figure out what you're actually parting with your money for. So there's the whole, you know, buyer beware thing as well.
Well, I was just going to ask you that question, actually, because from a buyer's point of view, you know, and typically these are people that aren't necessarily well versed in fintech, because they, you know, they're often being sort of presented with lots of different ideas. They look very good. They look like they do work. How can a customer sort of tell the difference? I mean, it's not easy, is it, really? Especially if it's a tech you don't understand.
Well, it's not easy, but you kind of have to get under the hood of it a little bit. And if you know you're going to be, it's like you don't buy a car without opening the bonnet, do you? So, you know, it's if you're going to invest in, you know, whether it be software, whether it be hardware, whatever it might be, you know, as a customer, if I say to you, you know, I love your car, you know, can I buy it? And you say, oh, I'm only going to show you photographs. there's a little bit of dubiousness going on there, isn't there? I want to come and touch it and kick its tires and open the bonnet and have a look and sit in the steering wheel, you know, sit in the driver's seat and drive it around the block a little bit. So as a buyer, my logic would be, if you can't answer me those questions and you can't let me, you know, okay, you get tire kickers that turn into time wasters, but at the same time, if you can't say, yes, you can play with my product, of course you can. I mean, especially in this day and age of software, you know, you can give somebody, you know, a 24-hour license to play with it, or a week's license to play with it, or whatever it might be. It's not an all or nothing purchase. And so if you say, you know, please, can, yes, here's some photographs of my car, give me money. If I say, oh yeah, of course you are, here's a check, then at that point, I'm kind of the fool, aren't I? So yeah, it's a really tricky one, but unfortunately the onus has to be, I think, on the person parting with the money to make sure that the money they're parting with is, you know, going to get something sensible back in return.
One of the things we've found a big challenge in terms of dealing with local authorities and trying to deliver the Trustfolio credit platform into local authorities, we're competing against hundreds of different fintechs all saying they can do this, all saying they can do that. And one of the things that works really well for us, and I think I'm convinced this is how we got the biggest local authority on board at such an early stage, was that free trial period, where we said, look, we're so confident in the product. It's not just us saying it. We're going to give you 3 months to use the platform, and then you decide yourself if it's invaluable. And hey, we're still using it now, a year later. So that's one of the things I think that new startups have to consider if they've got to stand by the product and take a bit of a hit over the first few months.
That's it. And then if you add to that, you know, if you're willing to you know, put something out there, it can be very clear, you know, it's a limited functionality, or it's not the full product yet, or it's out there as a pilot, or whatever it might be. But you have to, you know, as a supplier, you have to give a bit as well. And then you sort of get the ball rolling, because once you've then got people, you know, using your product, you then are living in a world of, okay, now I've got real people in the real world using my product. So I can then get some testimonials. And then that means that when other people are buying something, they go, oh, actually, well, you know, such and such a city council or whatever, oh, I've heard of them. You know, so actually, right, so there are real people using this and saying real things about it, you know. And then you can sort of put where you've got sort of these, you know, sort of minimum viable customers who like you and say nice things about you, you know, but have also given you real money, then, you know, they can quite often be your champions going forward, and that they will, you know, in public say nice things about you and endorse your product. And then you sort of, I mean, the fundamental thing is, you have to, I don't like to use the word integrity, but kind of is that. Like, as a vendor, you have to, you know, operate in your own world of integrity, and you have to plow your own furrow, because you're never going to compete with the noise. It's a bit like when people say, oh, I'm going to, you know, they try and chase social media algorithms. I mean, you're never going to win that game. So, you know, the algorithms go up and down like this. And so if you try and chase them, you're always going to be a step behind. But if you just steadily plow your own furrow through, you'll kind of intersect with the algorithm enough, you know, that good things will happen. But also you're just going in a straight line in the direction you need to be going in. And it may feel like you're going slower, but if you've got the right product and you've got the right strategy and you've got the right marketing right from prior to day one, which I would, you know, keep coming back to, you know, where I quite often get involved with companies is, they go, right, we've got a product and we've got some salespeople and we've done this, we've done that. And I'm like, well, have you actually spoken to any customers to see what they might like? And they go, oh, didn't think about that. And I said, have you thought about your routes to market? And they go, oh, I haven't thought about that. And I'm like, have you thought about your customer journey and where, how they go from zero to I love you, you know, with some stuff in between? Oh. And so it's about plowing your own furrow and just having the integrity to rise above all the noise. But at the same time, have a plan. Know what you're actually trying to achieve. And if you can put all those bits of the jigsaw together, then, you know, I don't want to say like only the good succeed, but you kind of get to that point where you can't be distracted by too much noise going on. You just have to, you know, get on and do your thing, really.
Yeah. I think Peter would agree with this. I mean, marketing, some people overlook that and see that as a spend that they can't really afford, where I think of that in a total opposite way. And you will as well, Nicky, no doubt. But I describe our project manager. We've just did an onboarding workshop with our first financial services creditor. And I always introduce Andy as the brains behind the technology. He built the platform. He's the tech expert you go to with any questions. But he'll admit himself, he wouldn't be the one who goes and markets and sells it. And that's a really important part of any process. You've got to sort of understand who your communicate with? Is it an operational person? Is it a procurement person? Is it a compliance person? And how you market that product is fundamental to the success or failure of it. And you've got to have that expertise and skill set as part of your business plan, I would say.
You would think so. And even before that, I mean, even you know, coming down to, if you go back to, you know, I mean, you can see all my books behind me, right? I'm a proper, I'm not a textbook marketer, but the reason I don't have to be a textbook marketer is because I know all the textbooks, and therefore I can tweak and I can twiddle and I can polish and I can break and I can pull together what a specific client actually needs. But without the robustness of all the framework, I mean, I've got my own frameworks, but I haven't invented marketing. You know, it's been around forever. And to me, I mean, this is one of my sort of bandwagons that I will consistently say, you know, marketing is everything that comes between your business and your customers. It is that simple. And so, but I keep, again, as you say, Lee, people say, well, it's, you know, marketing is a cost center. I also agree with that. Marketing is a cost center because it's really, really hard to draw a direct line between marketing and revenue. And anybody that says they can measure that in a B2B long sales cycle technology environment is either lying or deluded or both, because it just isn't possible. You cannot attribute a single sale to a single act of marketing. Because was it this email? Was it that email? Was it the lunch we had? Was it the meeting we had? Was it the fact that, you know, somebody in the company knew the guy's, you know, son from playing golf? You don't know. So people do, they view marketing as a cost, which it is. But they also say, so I've started talking about just building businesses. If you look at most of the stuff I don't even mention the word marketing for this very reason. So I'll sort of say to people, you know, they go, well, you know, we'll think. So firstly, people go, marketing is tactics. And I explain, well, it's a lot more than that. And then they go, oh, well, we'll think about marketing, you know, after we've got our product done. I'm like, yeah, marketing helps with that. After we've got our investment, marketing helps with that. After we've got our sales organized, marketing helps with that. So it then gets to you jump through the third hoop. And I kind of go, well, are you building a business? Because they all got no money for marketing. I'm like, are you building a business? Yes. Well, what are you doing then if you're not actually investing in marketing with a capital M to help build that business? What are you spending your money on? Oh, I'm spending it on technology. Okay, well, have you asked the customers what they want? Have you actually got a plan for a minimum viable product? Do you know what the competition's up to? Okay, that's marketing. So how can you actually build a business without marketing with a capital M? It's just not possible. But I had a whole, I'll call it friendly banter, shall we? The other day, with a CEO of a tech company, who literally was just saying, "Well, marketing is just tactics," you know. And I'm like, "Well, okay. Well, I'm not gonna win this argument. I'm not gonna even have this argument." You know, and his logic was, you know, "Oh, I know who the CEO of these companies is. I know who the CTO of these companies is. I don't know who the CMO of these companies is. Therefore, it's not important." And then I come back to my other point, which is that the CMO is the invisible glue that holds an organization together. It's not about glory. I mean, if you're in marketing, it's not about the glory. 98% of what I do is invisible unless I make a holy mess of it, which I don't. And so you don't have to know who a company's CMO is, because the CEO is the figurehead. The CTO is the figurehead. The sales, to a certain extent, is the public face. The marketing is this invisible glue that holds all of that together and helps build a business for success. And I will keep saying this, you know, because I do. And I, you know, and people go, well, why don't you just play the game and pretend that marketing's tactics and then, you know, get in that way? And I'm like, no, because I don't believe that. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I can't say that.
I'm smiling that you remind me of a conversation years back. I worked for a big company, and there's a guy who I really liked, really respected, great at what he did. But I once said, I was telling him I was off to a meeting with Mark, and he went, "Oh, we call them the colouring in people." And it's just a view, isn't it, from very operational people who's been sort of stuck in the ways of doing things in a certain way. They don't see it. They don't see exactly all the stuff you've talked through there from a marketing perspective, the impact it has on lots of different parts of the process.
It is. And there's no point picking fights that you won't win. So I just, again, it comes out to plowing your own furrow. I do my thing. And I realize that the more I talk to, you know, grown-up people running grown-up businesses, they actually, you know, are on board with the view that marketing is really important right from day zero, and that it is a mindset, and that, yes, it's a cost center, but without it, you know, so you don't know, you can't tie marketing to revenue. But I tell you what, without it, you can tell what revenue is lacking. So, you know, you just have to look at it that way around, really.
Do you think for the smaller organisations, the smaller fintechs just starting out where budgets are really tight, do you think they can train and develop themselves to market effectively? Or do you think they really need to have expertise brought in?
I think they can, but they need help with it. So that's where sort of mentoring comes in. I mean, I've got a whole thing that I do, which is kind of called own your own marketing. And I do believe that smaller organizations can get to where they can own their own marketing. But yes, they may not have much budget, but then I get somebody said to me, well, this is a case study. This company, they're spending $100,000 a month on social media, right? And then they go, and they want to do this rebranding and this remarketing this. And, you know, where would you get the budget from? You know, I'm like, well, I'd stop the $100,000 and use it on this. You know, I don't quite understand why you're saying if you're spending $100,000 on social media a month and you're, you know, you want to do a rebrand, then clearly that $100,000 a month you're spending is not working. Otherwise you wouldn't be able to do that. So I think people also, they underestimate the fact that marketing does not have to be an expensive thing. I mean, I am brains over budget with every single project I do. And this is the other thing. I mean, I can, you know, and I've done it, and I talk about it on LinkedIn, as you have seen. I literally say within like a half day, I can like throw a whole business up in the air, reassemble it as it lands, get that business organized for the next 6 months of what they need to do. They'll have a day by day plan. And people go, oh, that's too expensive. And I'm like, but you've just budgeted $5,000 a month for social media. Spend a lot less than that on me or whoever else, you know, other suppliers are available, you know, for half a day. And you don't have to throw all that bad money. You know, it's much better to just stop and regroup and go, right, what do we actually need to do? And I love nothing more than going in. And I do think marketing is a mindset. And it's also, and I say this often, it is a skill that can be learned. And this is where a lot of marketers give marketing a bad name, because they treat it like it's magic, like it's some, you know, dark art. It's not. It's a learned skill like any other. But where people need help is just unpicking the fact that you can wake up and, you know, there are 100,000 things you could do. Marketing, you know, it breaks the laws of physics. You know, it could expand the you know, to fill all the space and budget available, or you can just squidge it to nothing under the weight of all the other things you need to be doing in your business. So where they need help is not in doing marketing. It's in focusing and prioritizing from all the marketing that is available and then putting a plan together. And then it can absolutely be executed in-house. And I think, again, this is where sort of the whole fractional model is really popular now, because I don't think you don't need a full-time marketer, you know, on day one of running a company. You just need marketing, and there is a difference.
I think we learned quite early on in the Trustfolio proposition. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, I see you write occasionally on LinkedIn, and this whole idea of translating technology to human. The Trustfolio platform it's underpinned by blockchain. And we originally thought blockchain was going to be such a whiz-bang sort of thing to talk about, because it's immutable, it's this, it's that, it's the other. And on more than one occasion, we went down little sort of, I would say comedy cul-de-sacs, but we went down little sort of roads of no return trying to describe what blockchain was to a lot of sort of very blank faces, to the point where we actually stopped talking about it, because we realized it was a feature, not a benefit. And I mean, that takes me back to my teens when I was being taught about marketing and so on, and selling in particular. Translating technology to humans is not easy though, is it?
No, because if it was easy, everyone would just do it. I mean, it isn't easy. And I mean, one of the reasons I am equipped to do it is that my first degree is in computer science, which stands me in really good stead with my tech clients, because one of the things that I find is really important, I will go full circle to translating technology to human. All of my stories go somewhere, but they come back to where they started, which is the fact that, you know, if you can get a CTO on board with what you're trying to do, you're in really good shape in a tech company. And so I'll chat to the CTOs and I'll be like, look, I'm never going to know as much as you do. I never want to know as much as you do, but I know enough to understand what you're telling me, to ask you lots of questions, and to spot if you're trying to talk absolute nonsense at me from 100 paces. That will not fly. And so it's really about just asking lots of questions and realizing that, you know, if I can understand it, then it's coming back to, you know, you don't know with a child, it's like, you know, why? And to be fair, with a five-year-old, you do eventually get to, because I said so, as the answer.
Yes.
But when you're translating technology to human, you can actually stop before that. So by adding much of why and which means that and so that, and just sort of, you know, adding bits to the sentence, you carry on. So if you said to me, you know, oh, we use blockchain technology, I'd be like, okay, you know, well, tell me more. You go, well, it's a blah, 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 and I'm like, which means what in the real world? And then you start saying, well, actually. And then if you can start using, you know, using, this is where metaphors and language are really important. So if somebody said to me, you know, instead of going, you know, I've got a modular, holistic system of software, blah, blah, I'd be like, what? And if they go, well, actually, you know, we can build you, it's Lego blocks, and we build the wall of the size you need. Right, now I'm beginning to actually understand what it is you're telling me. And so you break it down into its constituent parts and explain all of the different parts. I did a post, actually, I think it was yesterday, about, you know, complexity is not the problem. It's failure to communicate that is the problem. And so if you break things down into their constituent parts and explain each of them, you can then sort of build it back up again and explain the whole. But you do have to be careful not to then go to the opposite extreme and just say something so holistically generic that it means nothing. I mean, there was one, and I probably shouldn't use the words, but if you look at a website, so we, you know, we synergistically, holistically embrace the power of such and such. I'm like, I don't even know what you do. I don't know whether you're, you know, a car driver or a lumberjack. You know, I just don't know what you actually do for a living at this point. So you do have to get this sort of this nice middle of there's the technology at the bottom and then there's this ground sweeping statement at the top. And you kind of got to make the two meet in the middle in a way that makes sense and actually says what you do for whom and why. Mm. You know, how many times have you looked at a website and you thought, oh, okay. And then you thought, I don't know what I'm buying. I don't know what leaves the building. I don't know what I asked one client once. They said, well, we do this and we do that. And I said, okay, what do people actually give you purchase orders for? And they kind of went, oh, we don't really know. I'm like, well, there we go. Then you think we should fix some of that then.
Yes. Well, it sort of takes us back almost to what we were discussing at the beginning in terms of, you know, how you describe it, it looks all glitzy and everything, but I couldn't. There were so many products I looked at that I just sort of thought, I don't think I'm particularly unintelligent, although Lee will probably challenge me on that. But I'd sit there and think, I really don't get it. What on earth are you selling me? But one of the other things I wanted to ask you about, another a word that you use, which I think is very, very good, vaporware. Now, that sounds like a really fintech description of hot air. Is that what it is?
It is, but I mean, that word's been around for donkey's years. I mean, I don't know where I got that word. I threw it into an email, and then you both really, really liked it. And it's like, I just remember it from years and years ago, where it was exactly that. It was like the whole, you know, all fur coat. Was it the same saying in, you know, in Texas, you know, the cowboys, like all hat, no cows, kind of, no, all hat, no cattle, or whatever it is. It's probably the polite version of what I was going to say. And it is exactly that. It's just, it is the whole, comes back to the whole smoke and mirrors thing. And that, you know, there's actually, when you sort of start, you know, I just imagine this like fluffy cloud, you know, and it looks great, but you start poking it and realize that there's actually nothing there.
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely. And
I don't know that there's a way to get over that. I think it has to be, like Lee was saying, you know, you let customers play with it. If you said, well, I'm thinking of buying, you know, your piece of software, you know, could I have a, you know, a week's trial or whatever it might be? If a vendor says no, then either the vendor hasn't got their system set up correctly, in which case that in and of itself is a concern, or they've got nothing to let you play with, which is a bigger concern, quite frankly.
So
I don't know that we're ever going to get away from vaporware, but I just think that, you know, it does come back to, you know, if you're the one parting with your money, the onus is kind of on you to, you know, be sensible about it.
Yeah. Quite often at the beginning of these podcasts, we tend to talk about sort of, you know, what someone does as their hobbies or pastimes. I've got to ask you, having listened to you now for, well, a good length of time and some very, very interesting stuff, what does a 360 marketing consultant do in her spare time?
Yeah. What sort of hobbies do you think I'd have, Peter?
You've got so many books in the background there. I'm sure you're an avid reader. Yeah, I'm dying to ask you. Now, if you're listening on the podcast, you won't know what I'm talking about, but take a look on LinkedIn for some of the video clips. I've got to ask you what the Chinese writing is behind you. And I don't know, right? How can I answer that question without
getting a few wrong or offending you terribly? You can't win that one, can you?
No. I know those sort of positions.
I got that in the Solomon Islands, of all places, bizarrely enough. I went to speak at a conference in the Solomon Islands, as you do. Because for those people that don't know, I spent 3 years as VP marketing for a global telecoms equipment company in New Zealand. So I've been working for myself for 24 years, but in the midst of that, I had 3 years as VP marketing for this global company. And the first time I went to New Zealand, it was when all the ash cloud stuff was going on.
Right, yeah.
And so I got stuck in New Zealand. I was going to New Zealand for a week and I got stuck there for like 3 weeks. So they said, oh, well, we need someone to go and speak at this conference in the Solomon Islands. And I stood still and everyone else took 3 steps backwards. So, well, that'll be me then. And this was literally my first week in this job. So I went to Australia and then I went to the Solomon Islands, and the Chinese vendor Huawei were sponsoring the all the schmoozing. And I got this in the raffle or something. It was just very bizarre. And it actually stands for continuous learning, which,
right,
as you can imagine, is one of my hobbies.
Of course.
The other thing that's it's immensely sad, but I do a lot of jigsaws, which is like I love doing jigsaws because and we've just got this massive man cave system out the back for my husband, which was a 12-week building project which took 18 months to do. So for ages all of the crap from the rest of the house was in my conservatory and I couldn't have enough table space to do a jigsaw for like 18 months. And now I finally, the reason it's called a man cave system is that there is no actual plural for cave, it's just cave system, which I also found out.
Right.
So dictionaries are also one of my hobbies. That's one of the things my dad taught me from a really early age. If you don't know a word, you look it up. And then you read the word to either side of it as well. And if you don't know what the plural of something is, you look it up in like a real proper, you know, dictionary.
Yes.
So now I've finally got my conservatory back. I have a jigsaw on the go all the time. So every morning, it makes me sound really sad and old. Every morning I do it. The two things that make my brain switch off are jigsaws and swimming. Because one, you just focus on where the bits go, and the other one, you just focus on, you know, getting to the other end.
Yes.
And they're the only two things that I found that just make my brain properly stop.
Well, I would never have guessed that, right, would I? We'd have been here for all day, and I would, you know, it would have been. But I have to say,
it's not gardening. I'll tell you that for nothing. It's not gardening.
I also love a good jigsaw. Me and my mum used to do jigsaws, and I haven't done a jigsaw for years, actually. I think the last time was on a particularly wet sort of fortnight in Anglesey, when me and my mum sort of got through a few, I think, actually. And yeah, they're actually really quite, well, they're quite therapeutic, aren't they?
They're lovely. And I found a whole new set, which is like, I've got one which is like an Agatha Christie one, and then I got a Shakespeare one and a Virginia Woolf one. And they're great because not only do you do them, but then they give you like this big poster with a key. So you feel like you're actually learning, like this is Malvolio and his cross garter stockings, you know, and you go and, you know, here are the, you know, the three witches and so on. And you feel like, it's probably educational by the time you finish. It's risking fun. I've got about 12 spare, Peter, if you want them, you know, I'll ship them your way.
I make them knocking.
I think a lot of people listening might be interested to know how they get in touch with Nikki.
I think the one point that I always think is really useful to sort of, I never really know how to say it, but I can help companies of any size, right? Because of what I do. But at the really, 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 really early stage of life, I kind of have to help people en masse because, you know, clearly they don't have the resources to, you know, to do lots. So the type of companies that I sort of, the real sweet spot is companies, it comes back to this whole planting a tree thing. You know, you should have done 20 years ago, failing that, do it now. I found that companies get to a certain point and they've kind of got, as I said, they get their founder and their CTO, and then they get some more technical people, and then they get a product manager person, and then they get a salesperson. And then finally, eventually, if they do get a marketing person, they sort of get somebody who's, you know, either a content person or a real generalist person. And there remains this gap between the CEO and this junior marketing person or a content marketer. And that actually gets companies into the whole actually having some marketing is worse than having no marketing was spiral, because the content person will go, here's my 2000 word article, read it. And the CEO will laugh them out the room, and you get in this spiral and nothing gets done. And that's kind of the sweet spot where companies kind of finally realize, I mean, I'd love to be there before, but it's normally only when companies reach the point where something is breaking or about to break or squeaks, or they suddenly realize, actually, we now need to start behaving like a grown-up company. That's when they tend to get me involved. Much as I'd love to be involved from you know, day minus one, it never tends to happen. So that's kind of my sort of sweet spot for you know, for entry. I don't really know where that's relevant, but that's kind of where people tend to find me, because they finally reach the point of going, actually, we now need to do something. It's only then that marketing reaches the properly important, you know, list of things to do.
Yeah, I think that's a really good explainer. That would help people who are thinking, how do I get in touch, or why would I engage with Nikki? I think that's a really good explainer.
What is the best way to get in touch with you, Nikki?
Well, I have my LinkedIn, which is just Nikki Dibben, which is very easy to find. My business is called Invention Marketing. But when you work for yourself, people don't know what my company's called until I invoice them, you know, quite often. So it really is me. It's Nikki Dibben. I am, you know, I think I'm the only Nikki Dibben on LinkedIn, actually. I do a lot on LinkedIn, but I also just love, you know, engaging with people. One thing I always, you know, say to tech companies, I will more than happily offer up my diary for sort of a 45-minute Zoom. And it's amazing what we can do. In the same way that I say, you know, give me a whiteboard, you and me in an afternoon, and we'll have sorted out any business issue that you've got. In my 45 minutes, you know, we may not have solved all the problems you've got in the world, but we'll have a lot better visibility of what your problems actually are. And then you can sort of go away and think about how to solve them. So I always happily offer 45 minutes, you know, to anybody that wants to kind of, you know, really just kind of, you know, unpick actually what the problems actually are. That gives them a lot more clarity at the end of that time. And I'm always happy to do that, whether you are a startup or whether you are more established. Because it's just about helping, really, at the end of the day, which sounds really trite, and I know that. But genuinely, if I can spend 45 minutes of my time and somebody goes away knowing what they're doing for the next 3 or 6 months, then the world's a better place.
That's fantastic. It's been really, really interesting talking to you. We always end up these podcasts by saying we could have spent a lot longer, but it's genuinely meant. So it has been fascinating. But thank you very much for joining Lee and myself today. I'm sure we'll be speaking again very soon.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a delight.
Great. Thanks, Nikki.
Thanks, Nikki. Thank you.
So that's podcast number 11 in the bag. Well done for lasting till the very end of the interview with Nikki Dibben. Those of you who've been avid listeners to these podcasts will no doubt be aware that we've been recording these for over a year now. Where does the time go? Remember to look out for podcast number 12, which we'll be recording in the next few weeks. We're not quite sure who yet from our list of experts we'll be talking to next, but whoever it is, we'll be asking them how they see digital resources being used better to help those customers in financial difficulty. In the meantime, if you'd like to know a bit more about what we lovingly call debt tech, do head over to trustfolio.co.uk on the World Wide Web.